being one of the largest financial institutions in the world, we have a lot of data. We have about 17 million clients, which means that every day we get a lot of transactions that tell us a lot about our clients. What the advisors were looking for is an asset we inherently have. We just trying to figure out a way to surface it in a way that the advisors could actually use that kind of knowledge. And we were doing that in our other products where we were leveraging all this transaction data to make more informed decisions about the right products for a client. But we hadn't really cracked the nut on how do we surface this for the advisor so they could have a better conversation with the client.
Hello and welcome back to Where AI Works, conversations at the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by the Wharton School in collaboration with Accenture. I'm your host, Peter Capelli, professor of management at the Wharton School and director of the Center for Human Resources here. It's our goal to cut through in these podcasts the noise to deliver actionable insights for business leaders by combining cutting-edge research with real-world case studies. As the great Elvis Presley said in a different context, a little less talk and a little more action. We're going to try to get practical here very quickly. Things are changing fast, so let's dive in. In this episode, I'm excited to explore the use of artificial intelligence in financial services, particularly in banking, really deep into white-collar work. One of the things I've learned in our own research about AI is that there's an enormous amount of conceptual discussion about how AI could be used, and there's very little really practical stories or examples about how it's actually being used. And so that's what we want to talk about today in the financial sector. And joining me for today's conversation is Soheib Perwais. He's the lead for the group business engagement operation of Borealis, which is part of Royal Bank of Canada that is the center of excellence for introducing AI. Thanks so much for being here and welcome to Where AI Works.
Thank you for having me.
He also reminds me he was a former student of mine here at the Wharton School. Before that, he had degrees at Harvard and Princeton. And he also reminded me that I gave him a good grade in the class, which I'm sure he deserves. So when you left Wharton, just want to know, and I think we're trying to ask everybody this question, how you ended up in this topic, which was something that didn't exist, this function that you're in now, didn't exist when you left Wharton. So from here to McKinsey, and then from McKinsey, I guess, to RBC, but how did you end up in this AI area?
Yeah, it was actually quite coincidental. I left Wharton thinking I'd be a management consultant, which is why I ended up at McKinsey. And at McKinsey, I just happened to, you know, find my home in banking. So I got really interested in the banking industry and worked across the globe with McKinsey on banking topics. I also got really interested in business building, like how to build new things that can change banking. And that's where I started getting exposure to AI through my clients, actually, back then. And what I was observing was that a lot of our clients, and perhaps, you know, this inspired the topic of this podcast, created AI as a shiny new thing that was for marketing and branding. I wasn't necessarily an expert in AI, but I was more and more keen on seeing how AI was actually being turned into value and dollars in banking. And that's kind of what drew me to RBC, Borealis, and then also AI. It's more the interest of like how banking is changing and the role AI is playing. And RBC seemed to be a place where they're taking value to heart and trying to do real things with AI as opposed to just marketing and branding tactics.
Do you think it helped to be not near Silicon Valley? I mean, Canada's got its own tech world, but did it help to be a little step removed and not so caught up in the shiny stuff?
I think it did help. I think it helped because I approached the problems that we're trying to solve with AI, not just purely from the lens of cool technology that could be deployed and finding a place to deploy it, but more from the core problems banks were facing that I saw as a consultant serving those clients, but then also being a client of banks, the problems that I had to deal with as a client. So to me, it helped because I didn't take the lens of what's the new cool tech I can bring to this problem. It was like, how do I just solve these day-to-day business problems that exist in this industry for the banks and for their clients?
I think that's also a core finding from the podcast so far is that if you start with a problem in search of a solution rather than starting with the solution, looking at places you can apply it, you're going to do much better. And it sounds like you have. So let's see if I could get you to tell us about something that you fixed at the bank using AI.
Yeah, for sure. I'll get very specific, but just maybe to give you a bit of a context, we are doing AI across the bank. We have a program that covers almost every part of the bank. We touch frontline productivity. We do general employee productivity. We do pricing. We do everything. I'll zoom in on an example I think that's just really easy to make tangible, which is in our advice center. So RBC has an advice center that's one of our major channels where clients can call us with questions, concerns, to get a new product, to change a product, et cetera. We have about 4,000 colleagues that work in our advice center. sector. Starting with the pandemic, but more recently with our acquisition of HSBC Bank in Canada, we were finding that the volume of calls coming into our advice centers was decreasing dramatically. So clients, perhaps because their preference for calling in rather than going into the branch or using online tools, we just saw volumes of call increase and the complexity of those questions that clients were asking our advisors increase. That was compounded by the fact that we generally have a high attrition and turnover within our advice centers. So on the one hand, we're seeing increasing volume, increasing call complexity. On the other hand, we have to keep reskilling and upskilling our advisors because they're just naturally changing. So we got to a point where, and this is, I guess, the crux of the business problem, is the status quo became unsustainable. And we had tried the traditional digital tools. We had digitized a lot of our workflows. We had digitized a lot of like our policies and procedure libraries that often our advisors go to answer client questions. But none of that was able to like surmount the wave that was coming at us in terms of like the call volume and complexity. So that was the business problem. Where we started was, how do we empower our advisors or give them more skills and tools so that A, they can do more calls, but also that those calls aren't just transactional question answer or sell you a product kind of type of conversations. How do we enrich those conversations with clients so advisors also feel more excited and engaged about their day-to-day and the conversations they're having with our clients? So on the one hand, we wanted to reduce the time it takes to answer a client question or engage with the client over these calls. On the other hand, we just wanted to make it a better experience for both the client and the advisor. So we started with the basic stuff. When a client calls, what is happening most of the time in that call? So I say, like, I have missed a credit card payment. What are my options? Or I have lost my credit card. What do I do next? And we found that 80% of the time in that call, our advisors are actually like searching for the answer through our policies and procedure libraries. Because often in banking, as you can imagine, heavily regulated industry, lots of rules to follow. Our advisors want to make sure they give the client the right answer, but that process was taking a lot of time. So we thought, okay, like, let's start there. Let's start making that part easier because that seems to be taking a lot of time. So that's where we started our first application of generative AI in our advice center. And this was about almost 2 years ago now, where we started with like an LLM that could actually just help answer those questions in natural language with advisors. So rather than if you call and say, I've missed credit card payment, rather than the advisor going to like search for like the exact policy or procedure that would help address that client concern, it's almost like a Google search bar where they could say that the client has missed a credit card payment, they missed it yesterday, they have this kind of card, how can I help them? And then the response the LLM would give back was, okay, here are the three steps you should tell the client. Oh, by the way, the clients generally like to hear that it's all going to be okay as well. So maybe like throw that into the conversation. So that was where we started. And we found that started having a huge impact in terms of call time. We started seeing that go down. And we started seeing that within like 6 or 7 months of deploying the solution. So we started scaling this across our advice center. Then we started honing in on the other problem. How do we enrich this conversation? So it's not just about the client saying, I lost my card or I missed a payment. What do I do next?
So can I pause you just a second to make sure we've got this? Yep. So this is not a chatbot. This is helping the agent, the human, give quicker answers. And then from there, we're going to talk about expanding what they can say. So it's assisting the agent. It's not replacing the employee.
100%. And then the second part was, how do we enrich the conversation? We really went out there and listened to the advisors and said, what's your ideal conversation with the client? And we heard consistently that it's like a conversation where they understand the client, they can get to know the client better, they can go deeper into the problem that the client is bringing to them. So our advisors were saying, we just want to better serve the client and understand the client better. Now, the good news is at RBC, being one of the largest financial institutions in the world, we have a lot of data. We have about 17 million clients across North America and the world, which means that every day we get a lot of transactions that tell us a lot about our clients. And if you've been a client with RBC for, let's say, even half a year or like even a couple of months, we can learn a lot about you through how you interact with us. So what the advisors were looking for is an asset we inherently have. We just tried to figure out a way to surface it in a way that the advisors could actually use that kind of knowledge. And we were doing that in our other products where we were leveraging all this transaction data to make more informed decisions about the right products for a client. But we hadn't really cracked the nut on how do we surface this for the advisor so they could have a better conversation with the client. So what we started doing was, as soon as a client calls, we recognize who the client is based on the authentication they do with the advisor. And then immediately on one screen, they can actually search for our policies procedure library through the tool I just mentioned. The second screen is basically a client profile. This is what the client is. This is how long they've been with RBC. This is the products they hold, et cetera, et cetera. That this client has been with RBC for 3 years. They have a first home savings account. They're probably thinking about getting a mortgage. You may want to ask them about if they're interested. And if they are, you may want to send them to our mortgage specialist. Or this client has been saving a lot in their savings account. They should maybe consider a GIC or a term deposit where they can make more interest. The innovation here was just surfacing this for the advisor so they could engage with it, interact with it, and have that deeper dialogue with our clients while they were on that call.
I imagine one of the things you have to think about a little bit is how much information do you want to give the agent to pass on to the client and yet not make the client feel creeped out about this? You know, like I see you missed a payment. Did you have to market test this or something to figure out, you know, what the boundaries would be, what's too much, what's not enough? The agents were helping you with this, I guess?
Definitely, we're getting feedback from the agents. We collect active in-market feedback from our clients as well. And So like, we actively monitor that. But we have some inherent guardrails on that too. Our advisors can only know the standard information that our clients know our advisors have.
Okay.
So when a client authenticates, they've already given us permission to know what their account numbers are, what account holdings they have. So that's the information that the advisor can see directly. All the other insights are not super specific enough, I would say, to be creepy. It's generalized enough, and this is what at least what we're seeing from the feedback we're getting, that it's not creepy. So it's not as if I'm going to say, like, unless you tell me that you missed a payment, I'm not going to be the one who tells you you missed a payment. And in fact, our advisors won't be able to see that until the client tells them that. It doesn't come off as creepy because it's based on data that the client knows we have and that they've also given us permission to surface for the advisor.
Do you see a next step in this? I mean, one could imagine, for example, the large language model could suggest ways to phrase the conversation and they could draw on some marketing tools and things. Do you want to go down that path or you think what you've done already is enough and leave the human dimension here?
I think the human dimension will stay just because we believe it's important for the client relationship. We are definitely open and are exploring how we take this to the next level. We actually have a training tool now that we're using with generative AI to like coach our advisors on how they can have more engaging dialogue with our clients, answer certain kinds of questions. So we're certainly open to that. We're just very hesitant to take this kind of technology to market up in front of clients until we've gone through rigorous testing.
Do you think, I mean, there are people who would say, boy, well, this is great. Just dial it up a little bit further, make an enhanced chatbot and get rid of the agents altogether. I'm sure somebody's thought about that approach, but you guys aren't going in that direction. Any sense as to why not?
Our hypothesis, and the industry may like prove us wrong right now, is that the human connection is important for the client. The human layer actually adds a bunch of value that purely AI couldn't. And again, like there's a world in which we can have like an agentic AI system that can orchestrate it all. But where we are right now, where our clients are right now, we feel like the human connection, the human overlay is actually very important for establishing that relationship.
But even given this, and you're going to keep the agents, it sounds like productivity in terms of calls handled is probably gone up because they can do all this stuff faster, right?
100%. And that's not to say that we're never going to change how we're structured or our workforce is structured. Our intent right now was upskilling so they can have more engaged dialogue with our clients. Those are the business problems we're trying to solve today. And that didn't require a massive overhaul of our workforce.
Just on that one, what's the reaction to the agents when you rolled this out? Were they nervous about it? Were they happy once they got it? What was that process like?
It's been very positive. And there are a couple of reasons like why we think that was. One, because of the pervasiveness of tools like GPT as a consumer product in the market, a lot of folks know how to engage with LLMs. So like the usability was very high. So like our tool that enables our advisors to like go in and like search for answers, it's the kind of tooling they're already using at home with ChatGPT or Perplexity or the other tools out there. The second part of it was, it actually elevated the type of conversations they were having with our clients. So like our client engagement went up, our NPS went up. I feel like our advisors were experiencing that more positive client reaction firsthand, which was also just, I guess, making that experience more rewarding for them.
That's a good outcome. Shall we switch now and ask you to tell us about another one? And we had our druthers, maybe something different.
Yeah.
What else have you done that you think would be an interesting variation here?
It's definitely something different, and it's in our mortgage business. And the technology is also quite different because it's more in the background than like, you know, what I just described as something like our advisors can touch and feel and work with. The use case I'm going to walk you through now is a bit more behind the scenes, so to speak. So maybe just to give you a bit of context, RBC is obviously one of the biggest bank in Canada. Also, we have one of the biggest mortgage businesses in Canada. It's very important for us as a business, but it's also very important for our clients because home buying, as you can imagine, is one of the major anchors of a relationship any client has with their bank. Historically, we've done pretty well in our mortgage business, our retention rate. So that's when a mortgage is coming up for renewal. And by the way, maybe just for context, since most of the listeners may be American, American mortgage market is unique where you have 30-year mortgages. In Canada, our mortgages are usually 3 to 5 years. Which means for banks, renewals are a big deal. Getting new mortgages on the book is important, but it's almost equally important that we keep those mortgages on the book when they come for renewal. RBC has a pretty good track record of doing that historically, like 90%-ish plus minus retention rates. A couple of years ago, we started to see a bit of a change there where our renewal rates weren't as positive as they used to be. And we started to see a bit of a dip. generally how it has worked in the mortgage industry in Canada is once you hit 180 days before renewal, you get a letter from your bank saying you're up for renewal. And then different banks have different strategies. They'll try to reach out to you throughout that process. And the hope is before that 180 day window runs out, you renew with that bank. If you opt not to renew, obviously you will go to another bank. But our goal is within that 180 day window to get a client to renew. We started seeing that our retention rate started to go down a few years ago, A, because the market became very competitive in terms of pricing. So the housing market was, I think, across North America, but particularly in Canada, pretty hot. Lenders were very aggressive with pricing, and lenders were also very aggressive with how they were engaging clients. RBC was beginning to feel a bit of that pressure. So once we like dug a little deeper, we found, well, how is our process set up right now? And does it, like, if you do first principles, does it make sense? And the way our process was set up was we sent a letter, and then we basically like have a rules-based approach of during that 180 day window, like here are the four or five ways in which you're going to engage with a client. We'll try calling you. We'll send you an email. If you go to the branch, then we'll remind you. That doesn't work in today's world. I may never go to a branch. I may never want to talk to someone on the phone about my mortgage. And each client is different that way. Some clients will make their decision just 30 days before the renewal window. Some clients are more conservative. They want to do it 3 or 4 months in advance. So our hypothesis here was this like one-size-fits-all approach for how we engage with our clients when it comes to the renewal window is not meeting the needs of the day and what our clients expect. So we started building an AI solution that could help, again, because we know clients very well. These are clients that have been with us at least for a few years, given they have a mortgage with us for a few years, and often tend to have other products. We know these clients pretty well. We understand them. We have a lot of data on them. So there's no reason we can be a bit more tailored and a bit more custom in how we engage with them in that renewal window. So what we started doing was we started looking at that data, surfacing insights about like how a client wants to be engaged in that mortgage window. Some clients, like I said earlier, only want to hear from us 30 days before. Some clients only want to be engaged on the mobile app. Some clients want an email. Some clients want to go to the branch. And we started like making those active live predictions through this model that we built. So like our clients are being engaged in the way, exactly in the way they want when they hit that 180 day window.
So was this a machine learning type exercise where you're looking at renewal as the outcome and then you're trying to see what differentiates why some clients renew and some don't, and you're going from there? Is that this kind of an inductive data science-y machine learning exercise rather than a large language model thing? Yeah,
you got it. At a high level, that's exactly it. The outcome we were optimizing for was retention, and that's the business outcome that we're tracking. And we basically looked at what are the different drivers of retention for a client and then basically started optimizing for retention for around those features.
That kind of approach is pretty data intensive, right? And kind of expensive in computer power to do. Did you find that? Was it harder than, for example, the earlier one with the agents to do in terms of the computer science and the programming tasks?
In terms of the data, absolutely. But not necessarily the compute. I won't get into the specifics of the comparison of like how much like the compute was between the two solutions, but the data was far more complicated. I think the defining thing was the different channels. Because the way our bank is set up with our legacy tech, each channel has a different monolithic tech system. And then marketing sits outside of it. So for example, like part of our personalization strategy was also customizing which marketing copy goes to which client. And our marketing systems are not set up to do that. They're not set up to like operate at a client level. And our channels are not set up to like pass around client actions seamlessly either. So like, for example, when we send a batch of leads to a branch, we will then send a batch of leads via email, or we'll send a reminder message through email. Like we have all these batch processes in somewhat siloed monolithic systems. Trying to traverse that was the big challenge here. Like, how do you like actually get to a client-specific action or recommendation? It has to happen through all these various systems and data sources we have.
Well, actually, that's maybe the last question for you, but it is a big one. And that is the way you folks are handling this, RBC, but particularly, you know, your Borealis group, you're the kind of center of expertise that is going around different parts of the bank where you can't be experts in advance on how each of these little particular tasks work. How would you describe that to folks? I suppose the alternative is to try to, I don't know, what is the alternative to that? To distribute the expertise around the bank? Or what do you think the pros and cons of your approach is? It's not one that we see everybody doing.
Yeah. And like, I mean, from my consulting days, I saw a lot of like big banks take the federated approach. I mean, there are like a couple of like models you could do. One is the federated approach where like each business kind of has its own AI unit that is closest to the business, understands that business. Then you have a hyper-centralized approach, which is you have a center of excellence that formulates AI strategy. And then either like implements it directly or works with the businesses or other technology partners to implement it. We have a bit of a hybrid model in Borealis. So a couple of things on how we're set up and I guess the learnings from that. So we are centralized. We are a central enterprise function, but we also build. So we don't just pontificate on AI strategy, we build. And the other thing that we try to do very like distinctively is to like work very directly with the businesses. In fact, my entire team is set up to be that interface with the business and our technical teams. And we try to embed ourselves within the business, even though we are a central team. So once we say like we work with a business leader to figure out this is the problem we want to solve, it's not as we go away and just start building it and leave the business owner on the sidelines. We try to really partner with them on the ground and get their resources and our resources working together to solve the problem.
So is this very different than the management consulting work that you did before, or it rhymes, as they say? It's similar?
I would certainly say there are similarities. It's similar because part of my job and my team's job is going deep into a business, understanding their problems and translating that into some sort of practical solution. Where I think it diverges, the long-term ownership that we often end up taking with these solutions and these partnerships. And this is something like we're having an active debate on whether we should move to a consulting type model where we actually build a solution, hand it over to someone and then walk away and do something new. But traditionally, we don't just like set it up, framework it and walk away. We kind of stick around for the journey till the very end. And now there's a question about like maintenance and stuff, which we're still like sorting through which part of the organization owns that. But as of now, the way Borealis works is we don't just like start. We take it to the very conclusion. We make sure the business outcomes are there before we walk away.
And they know your phone number. So it's not like you can walk away. If there's a problem, they're going to follow up, right? Yeah. Well, this is a terrifically interesting discussion and it raises a lot of important questions for everybody to think about who's using AI. So Ed, thanks very much for coming back to Wharton here and talking with us on this topic today and sharing what you guys have been doing. It's really interesting to see.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's see if we can do some quick takeaways on this. A couple of things that struck me. The first, and then maybe the general one, is just the extent to which the introduction of AI successfully is very much deeply embedded in management issues, right? And particularly how to use the human agents and the AI agents together is an important decision. And you could imagine organizations have different views on that, maybe depending on the kind of customers and the way they want to interact with them. It's kind of a strategy choice. And the issue at the end about how you want to carry out this organizational change, which is a big deal, right? To change how work gets done and how employees have to deal with different technology. How do you get that started? How do you manage that process? A lot of important choices there, one of which, of course, is to outsource the whole thing, which is one extreme. And doing it internally, you still have lots of choices. So it's a really interesting facet of the discussion about introducing AI that has not gotten enough attention. That's all for today. Thank you all very much for listening. Please follow us so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to tune in next time for a look back at our highlights and the biggest lessons for this season from the podcast. This has been Where AI Works, conversations at the intersection of AI and industry, brought to you by the Wharton School in collaboration with Accenture. I'm Peter Capelli. See you again soon.